then flies in our apartment, which appear in summer especially, would say the following. Father fly would tell baby fly or son fly. He says, you know, this Zechariah Sitchin is immortal because my father told me that his father told him that as long as our family flies can remember, Sitchin was always around and he always looked then the way he looks now. So this whole notion that came out especially in the Greek tales, the Greeks sometimes referred in the tales of Homer to the so-called gods as the immortals, they also called them the giants and so on, they were really not immortal, but their extremely long life in the eyes of the Sumerians or of mankind was really not that long. Now, could they live in their terms 100 years or 120 or 200 years? Now, you know that in the Old Testament, mortals, men who were closer genetically to the time when that genetic manipulation had taken place, lived much longer. There's the mention of Methuselah in the Bible. There's the mention of Enoch, who lived 365 years until he was taken aloft and never really died on earth. So the answer to your first question is yes, they could be on earth those fantastically long times as far as we count the years, but to them there were just so many few of their years.
I think another thing to bring in, and you've mentioned it there, is that they were masters of genetic engineering.
Yes.
And if they can do that, make a Neanderthal woman what we are today, they certainly could use that genetic engineering on themselves to extend life.
There are tales, Bill, that speak of their reviving the dead. There is a tale of the goddess Ishtar who died and through radiation was revived,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Now, the second part of your question...
Can you hold on to it? While I do the second part of this over here. And Barbara, you stay right there, and Zachariah will answer the second part of your question. Yeah, Barbara.
Well, the second part, Barbara, of your question was...
Oh, my name is Carol, and I have written to you, so I would like to be known as Carol.
Oh.
Sorry?
Okay.
My computer said Barbara.
All right.
Well,
go ahead.
Are you sure you're Carol?
Yes.
Okay. The second part of your question was, are they still here, or if not, will they come back? And this is something I really am disinclined to discuss at this point, because I'm answering those questions in my next book, and I'd like people to buy it and to read it, so you'll have to forgive me, but I would prefer not to answer.
Okay.
All right, now you've...
Thank you very much.
You've got something to hang your hat on there.
Yeah.
And look for the sequel to The Wars of Gods and Men, which has been published by Avon, which is one of our largest paperback publishers. The books are available just about everywhere. And while you're in there, you may want to ask for Stairway to Heaven and certainly The Twelfth Planet, the two previous books that Zechariah has written. And I will guarantee you they'll hold you spellbound all the way through. And we want to hold you spellbound for another hour, if we may. And we're talking about some fascinating stuff that comes out of the ancient writings of the ancient Sumerians about a group of celestials who came here, started the whole thing, and even gave us our first nuclear war. We'll find out more about that in this next hour. You're invited to come in and listen to Zechariah Sitchin. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. And just to kind of update you in case you just tuned in late, Zechariah's latest in his series of books is called The Gods of Wars of Men. It's available on Avon. It's in paperback. It's everywhere. And he is dealing with information that didn't come out of his mind other than the research that he did into the ancient Sumerian writings. And those ancient writers that go back thousands of years are telling us an incredible tale of a group of people who came here from another planet, one that swings widely in the system of planets that we live in, gets into our area about every 3,600 years, And when it's in close proximity to Earth, they started visiting Earth in these, in its wild swings, these elliptical swings, caused our civilization to begin, not only in its physical manifestations and what we are and what we look like, but our society as well, had wars because of us and the planets, and we have carried on. We have carried on in that tradition, unfortunately. Zachariah Sitchin. Zachariah, welcome to Hour 3. And they gave us our first nuclear war.
Right.
2024 B.C. The central point of that was a spaceport in what is now the Sinai Peninsula.
Right.
And the area around the Sinai Peninsula there certainly looks like it had been into some kind of war, doesn't it?
It does. There's a tremendous crater left there, and there's no, there's been no explanations for it hitherto, and I think I'm offering the only plausible one.
But it's not an explanation. It came out of just your imagination. It's in the ancient records.
It's in the ancient writings, and it's in NASA photographs from space.
It's amazing to me that those old writers should know about nuclear bombs, spaceports, spaceships, genetic engineering. And the list of technological wonders that they knew about then is staggering.
Well, it's amazing, one word to use. Others are less generous, Bill. They say incredible.
Well, incredible means not to be believed, and I try to stay away from that word
right.
as much as possible, because I think that what you have written is something that is worthy of looking at it and makes more sense than anything else we have seen. I just don't believe that those old writers were anything other than historians.
I think so too. As a matter of fact, Bill, I would not have written my books and certainly not have allowed them to be published before I myself was absolutely convinced beyond any doubt that those texts are telling us the facts, that this is not mythology, this is not fantasy, this is not imagination. These are facts that we read in those ancient texts, what really happened in ancient times in prehistory. There's no doubt in my mind about it.
And they were telling that story, at least to the best of their ability. And they give us characters, a cast of characters. They give us stories that would make a magnificent motion picture, but it would be one that has a lot of historical validity to it. And if you'd like to talk to Zachariah during this last hour, let me give you the numbers. All of our numbers end in talk. In Los Angeles, 520. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. In Orange.
Oh, Bill, I'm glad that this is Ivan, the Silmar wind turbine man, and I'm really glad that you finally had Zachariah Sitchin on as your personal guest. I've heard you talk to him on the phone, but I think this is the first time he's been a personal guest, isn't it?
That's true.
Mr. Sitchin, I've read both of your prior books, and one question I'd like to ask is about... The Smithsonian Magazine recently had an article about Platonics and the theory. And I would like you to comment on, would the result of the collision that you talk about in your books that occurred with the Earth, and the Earth is a result, with the asteroid belt, which was called the bracelet and so forth,
yes.
After the collision, would not there have been a logically... rearrangement of the landmass just to achieve balance, which would have given rise to the Platonic theory?
Yeah, you're talking about our Earth, right? About our planet.
Right.
Right. Now, obviously, that is what happened because according to the Sumerian cosmological views that are expressed in detail in a what was scholars called poem or the Epic of Creation... The ancient name was Enuma Elish. It's a well-known translated text, not made up by me, which describes how the whole solar system was created, describes the invasion of the solar system by the planet from outer space that the Sumerians called Nibiru and the Babylonians later, in honor of their supreme god Marduk, how it was drawn into the solar system, how it collided with an ancient, one of the earliest planets in our solar system, which was called Tiamat, meaning mother of life.
Mm-hmm.
And Earth is just
the
half, a remnant that is half of that planet. Now, so you can or you should visualize, and I have the actual sketch of it, one of the few drawn by me and not from actual archaeological discoveries. I show a sketch of the half-planet, which became the Earth, being thrusted through the collision, the force of the collision, to a new orbit, mm-hmm. which is our present orbit. So you have a planet, a half-planet, so obviously the landmass is on one side. Tiamat has been described in the Sumerian writings as a watery planet, so we have also inherited the water. And now you have a planet that through its constant revolution and through the gravitational forces in the solar system gradually becomes a globe. From a half orange becomes a full orange.
Yeah, it would have to rebalance itself.
Right, so it rebalances itself. We still have on one side the tremendous cavity filled with water, which is the Pacific Basin,
mm-hmm.
a tremendously deep cavity. And you had on the other opposite side all the landmass or the continents. Now as the planet keeps revolving and revolving, and gets its global, the shape of a globe, with all the gravitational forces working on it, gradually the landmass begins to spread, and this is the Platonic theory, except that no one of those who developed or wrote about the Platonic, or suggested the Platonic theory, could explain why, to begin with, was the landmass only in one spot. The Sumerians 6,000 years ago did.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't explain why we have the moon in such a perfect, very unnatural orbit as we see things. Just a circle.
Well, the moon, Bill, according to the same cosmological text, Enuma Elish, was one of about a dozen satellites of Tiamat, the planet that was broken up. And it was, which brings us to something I mentioned at the beginning of the evening, which was in the process of separating from the gravitational influence of Tiamat and becoming a planet in its own right, just as Pluto had become sometime later. That process was interrupted by the celestial collision with the invader, with Nibiru or Marduk in its Babylonian name. When the Earth, the half of Tiamat, was shunted to a new orbit, it pulled that large satellite with it, and thus has the moon, which was about to become a planet in its own right, thus it has become a satellite, so to say, of the Earth, which is the olden Tiamat or part of it. And this is why, as I said at the beginning of the evening, why the Sumerians considered the moon a celestial body in its own right,
mm-hmm.
whereas, say, the satellites orbiting Jupiter or Saturn don't count in the number 12.
Yeah, one of the things that comes to my mind, and we've had discussions about it before, is the unusual orbit of the moon around the Earth. That's almost a perfect circle. You don't see that usually in orbiting bodies. They're elliptical.
Right.
And the rotation of the moon on its axis is such that it doesn't vary as far as
how much is the Earth, right?
Almost as if it was engineered.
Well, they're almost like twins. In other words, they come from the same place,
mm-hmm.
another place in the heavens. They were thrust and shunted together, and they have remained in this synchronization ever since.
Well, you know, it's interesting if we were just a half a planet at one time. Excuse me, Ivan, just a second. I'll get back to you.
Okay.
The old stories about how you could fall off the edge of the Earth may have been true.
Well, yeah. If you could fight off gravity, you would.
Yeah, Ivan, go ahead.
Mr. Sishin, about a year or so ago, there was an article from the Naval Observatory that indicated that they felt that there was another large planet out there that was approaching. Could this be the approach of our planet that is the main story in your book?
Yes, I believe so. I've been in touch with the chiefs of the group at the U.S. Naval Observatory ever since they concluded originally that Pluto has a moon, a satellite, which led them to the conclusion that there must be another celestial body beyond Pluto. And just to give you one sentence from what they've been telling me and writing me is they said, let us catch up with the Sumerian knowledge.
Well, that's very, very interesting.
So we may have a celestial visitor here in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I wanted to ask him what year, but he said that that was going to be in his next book, so I won't ask him.
Right.
But Dr. Beck has referred one time to a book that he read that was titled Pharaoh's Pump. And this is not necessarily Dr. Beck's theory, but he said that the people in there put up a good proposition that the pyramids were actually pumps that raised the Nile water up to a higher level where they could irrigate. Have you run across anything similar to this, Mr. Sishin, in any of your studies?
Well, this was brought to my attention, and I really cannot explain or speculate on somebody else's theories.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I'm going to look forward to seeing you tomorrow because I'm certainly going to try to be there.
Thank you.
Ivan, when I was going down 210 the other day, your windmill didn't look like it was ginning.
Oh, well, it should have been if the wind was blowing.
Yeah, all right. I just want to make sure it was working all right.
But someday you're going to stop by and see me, right?
That's right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Ivan.
Thank you very much, Bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. High and 70 feet wide are so clear and the impact so great, you'll think you're actually attempting aerial maneuvers with the Blue Angels and being pursued by police during a thrilling high-speed chase. Experience a movie today at the new California Museum of Science and Industries IMAX Theater. Call area code 213-744-2015. And are you a woman? And Bill Jenkins with me in studio, Zachariah Sitchin. And we have on the line, William. Are you there?
Are you talking to me, Bill?
I'm talking to... Oh, this is Craig. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, Craig, you're on TV. There you are. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Bill.
Craig calls us from time to time, Zachariah, from way up north in California, to rig his radio in such a strange kind of way to hear our little signal.
Yeah, it's hard.
I hope you're enjoying the show tonight.
I've been trying to. I missed some of the details. So, in fact, I was going to say it's going to be real hard for me to talk about the details of what you're presenting here. First of all, the whole time you've been on tonight, I've been thinking about Emmanuel Velikovsky. And actually, I'm surprised nobody else has mentioned it. I'm sure you're familiar with his books.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, I noted some differences. What would you have to say in general about what he has to say and the differences with what you have to say?
Well, there are many similarities between us. He wrote, of course, many years before my books began to be published. And what he has done is he referred to biblical sources. He referred to Egyptian sources. For some reason, of which I'm not aware, he had no access. I think maybe he just didn't know those languages that I've studied. He had no access to the Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian sources. I don't recall in his books any reference at all to those sources, although they, as scholars now know and acknowledge, they are really the original sources of both the biblical, the Egyptian, and other tales, mythologies, or whatever one prefers to call them. So this is one difference or flaw in his writings. But he did go to the biblical and Egyptian, I think also some Greek sources, and he found in them references to a celestial collision. And he, thinking what it meant, concluded that there was some collision in rather recent, or we could say historical times, biblical times, that led to the creation of Venus. That Venus, he said, was a comet that was caught, orbited, was drawn into the solar system, and so on. Now, all that was very interesting, except I think he was wrong in his conclusion, because where were he to be aware of the Sumerian, Mesopotamian sources, he would have known, first of all, that Venus was one of the originally created planets in our system that were created in pairs.
Right, and it was already recognized.
And it was already recognized, say, by the Sumerians. And two, that it's true that the ancient sources speak of a celestial collision, speak of an invader from outer space that was caught into constant or perpetual orbit, but that is the planet that I call the 12th planet, and that the Sumerians called Nibiru, the Babylonians Marduk. So while he has done a lot of research and reached to some extent the same evidence, the same sources that I did, he stopped short. He had no access, perhaps, to the additional information, the additional sources that I had, or that I had access to. And thus, in my opinion, he reached the wrong conclusion.
Did you have a chance to speak with him or correspond with him before he died?
I was supposed to have met him, but he was quite sick by then, and we ended up not meeting.
Okay, well, let me move on to some questions here. I personally don't rule things out of hand, as being impossible. I mean, there's a lot of things about the past we just don't know. And there are a lot of people who talk about the possible existence of a 10th planet and many other things. To begin with, one real great difficulty with what you're presenting. And very simply, if there's an advanced species of life, a sentient life, that has adapted to living on a planet with an orbit such as you describe, I don't know how they would be able to survive on a planet such as Earth.
Why not?
Well, the conditions are so drastically different.
In what way?
You want me to point out all the ways I can think of?
By all means. Otherwise, how could I answer your question?
Well, okay. Tell me one thing. How close in does this putative planet come in its orbit?
It passes between Mars and Jupiter.
Okay. So that's its closest point. And
right.
And the furthest point?
Well, it has an orbit of 3,600 years, so you can figure it out.
Well.
it's far out, right?
Yeah, quite. How many astronomical units are we talking about?
Well, I have calculations, but...
But it's
for the average listener, it's far out.
Two or three times the orbit of Pluto, or what?
What's the difference? It's very far out,
okay,
right.
Fine.
It's far out.
In any event, for any kind of life to adapt to... changes in the radiative heat that they're receiving from the sun, for instance, that are so great between the two extremes of its orbit, I wouldn't know how to conjecture what form that type of life would take. But then to suppose that life form adapted to those extreme conditions could then successfully survive on planet Earth, our orbit is much closer, of course, than the asteroid belt. And we have a pretty stable, fairly regular orbit. It's really kind of hard to believe.
Well, they also have a fairly regular orbit, and like us, they have a summer and a winter. When they are out there, it's winter, and when they are nearer the sun, it's summer. And as I was telling a previous caller, to them, one orbit is 1 year. So they had 6 months winter and 6 months summer, and probably some spring and autumn in between. Except that to us, one of their years is 3,600 years. To us, their orbit seems an incredible orbit. But to them, probably the orbit of the Earth looked like a minor or relatively minute orbit.
When they're out that far, they really have winter.
But they did not depend. They did not depend on heat from the sun. Because the Sumerians described that planet in text and pictorially as a radiating planet, a planet that had
like
its own heat. Like, well, you know, Jupiter, in the neighborhood of Jupiter radiates more heat than it gets. But
right.
You know that in the neighborhood of Jupiter, they discovered sources of heat 2.5 times stronger than the heat emanated by the sun.
Well, then it's okay.
So the whole notion that the planet cannot have heat unless it's near the sun has been discarded by now.
Yes, I realize that. And if there's a life form living on such a planet with an orbit such as you describe, again, I don't see how they could successfully thrive on a planet like Earth. There had to be some. You know, when we talk about colonizing or in any sense setting up colonies, you know, small scale colonies on planets out in the solar system, we talk in terms of enclosed, say dome like structures or something. We bring our atmosphere. We create all sorts of modifications just to be able to survive, let alone thrive.
Well,
we
do that simply because the atmospheres to which we are used or that we need are either on those other planets are totally different or because they don't exist. For example, there's no atmosphere on the moon. There's a thin atmosphere on Mars. I believe there was an even better or greater atmosphere on Mars and probably dissipated in time, but some still left. So there are all kinds of theories that, for example, even on planets that we think have no oxygen or not sufficient oxygen, there's really enough oxygen in the form of CO2. So we're really going into very sophisticated scientific theories.
In a way, Craig, it sounds like if they come to Earth, it's like going to a South Sea island where the weather is very warm and balmy, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. I think the answer to your question really lies in what I consider to be the basic question, and that is, in view of all the knowledge that the Sumerians had 6,000 years ago, knowledge of astronomy and other sciences, how could they have known all that unless what they said, that those who had come from that planet told them, unless that is the answer, then there's no explanation.
Well, I'm sure.
So you're always back to the basic question.
I don't know enough about it to provide the explanation for that, but what I'm saying is I find the theory that you've proposed more than difficult to swallow. We still haven't even. I don't know if you do this in your books, but do you attempt any explanation for how an advanced life form adapts to such a planet?
Do you mean to tell me you are the only one in this country who hasn't read my books?
Sorry to say, I must be.
Well, I think that Bill Jenkins will invite me again next year, and after you read the books, ask me again questions. I'm sure you'll find some answers in the books.
Well, do you actually discuss this specific question?
Well, I discuss it in various aspects, scientifically and from those texts. I don't know if I answer every question the way you phrase it, but I do answer the
question.
I think the main thing to remember, Craig, is that he is just now giving you the information that the Sumerians had written down and sort of putting in a language that we can understand and information that is already there and information that has proven to be very, very accurate in the past as far as the descriptions of things that are going on. So it's not that he's conjured up a theory or a hypothesis, but rather he is repeating what has been told to us by ancient historians.
Well,
okay.
In many points, I'm sure that's the case. But in the final, I don't know how to put this.
I know how to put it. I'm going to have to go to a commercial.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay, Craig.
Well, I can't say I can go along with it.
Okay, well, I do.
Okay. But I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
All right. Thank you for taking all the trouble to listen way up there. I know it's difficult.
Okay.
Sitchin, and we are now going to talk to William. William?
Hi, it's good to be on with you, Zachary. I wanted to ask you, what year did you say they had come down to try to obtain the gold from the seas there in the Mediterranean area?
About 450,000 years ago, give or take.
Give or take a few months, yeah.
Okay. Also, I wanted to ask you, in your new book, which, do you happen to know what the title's going to be of the sequel?
Yes.
Okay. In there, do you sort of draw any conclusions as to what the encounter will be when that planet comes into our solar system? Is there sentient life there now? Is that discussed at all?
Well, we have both Mesopotamian and even biblical texts dealing with what happens on Earth when